Hello and welcome along to this week's RTE Rugby Podcast, and a very busy RTE Rugby Podcast this week. As you can see, if you're watching on the video, Johnny Murphy is with me right now. We'll be recapping Ireland's Guinness Six Nations win against Wales in Cardiff from last weekend. No game for Ireland this weekend, of course. It's a Six Nations break week. A couple of extra interviews, though, to come after this recap. Yesterday, I spoke with Hugo Keenan, get a little temperature check on how Ireland are getting on without Andy Farrell, among other, a few other topics. And we'll also hear from Max Deegan as well after he captained Ireland A last weekend. All of that to come. First, though, Johnny Murphy, as I said, is with me to recap Wales 18, Ireland 27. Johnny, Ireland, they kept the Grand Slam bid alive, Triple Crown in the bag, but nowhere near as comfortable as some people expected it to be.
It kind of started off a bit like how we expected it was going to be, particularly with the Conan try. I thought that was one where we kind of just muscled up, and even the instance of, you know, how he scores that, you know, in the act of scoring, he drives back, you know, it was. You know, he completely overpowers, the Welsh defender. And then everything was kind of going according to plan. And the pivotal moment for me, I think, was the pass on the edge from Osborne out. I think if that had gone to hand, I think the score would have been 17-3. I think it was 10-3 at the time, or 10-6 at the time. It would have been it would have lent itself to then kind of putting the foot to the floor and chasing those the extra two tries for what everyone expected would have been a bonus point win. And then Wales, you know, they kept fighting, they stayed in the game. Ringrose's red card, then that was it. Then it was kind of lined up, and it was kind of careful what, you know, what people were saying beforehand. It was like, look, you know, even on some coverages, you know, I think Rob Kearney said, you know, this is a game of rugby, it's Wales, we don't have a happy hunting ground there, you know, someone gets a red card, and then it was like you could see into the future. And to be fair, they then grounded out, you know, but I think it is interesting, and, you know, I haven't played there myself, it's incredible stadium. So the atmosphere on those international days must be, and I think the passion from everything in the lead up to that, with how they were, you know, how everything had been going, there was going to be a bounce regardless. So all in all, I think when you put it all together, look, it's 4 points. They got the job done and they move on, you know, without being overly critical or of them. But there is some stuff that definitely, particularly defensively, I think that collectively and as a team, that they need to, and some individuals, I think, are really important that they get right, because you saw what Sunday can bring with a dry ball, and when the ball sticks, what France can do.
And ultimately, like, I mean, while it was frustrating at times and a bit of a scare, obviously, it was a far more worthwhile exercise than a 35 or 40-0 win would have been, where, you know, if Wales had played like they played in the opening two rounds, Ireland obviously are getting a lot more out of it. I know a lot of it is picking apart some faults as well. But to go back and to give Wales their credit, I suppose, earlier on, like what you said right from the start was, Ireland dominated them early on, ran out to a 10-0 lead. Their first try from Jack Conan came after Joe McCarthy just picks and goes from the base of a rock and carries three or four people with him towards the line. A bit of scrappy ball. Gibson Park pops it up and Jack Conan just dots it down while he's holding Thomas Williams out in the other arm. And you're going, all right, this is going to be a pretty comfortable day. And they tag on another penalty and it's looking solid enough. But like, I thought that was probably the most impressive thing from a Welsh point of view, was that they didn't just kind of come out fast and cling on for dear life for the rest of the game. They actually had to adapt to a pretty difficult start and started landing some blows on Ireland, like got on top in the scrum. Obviously got a bit lucky with that poor pass from Jamie Osborne to Gary Ringrose, and worked their way back in through the game with a couple of penalties. And in fairness, for that middle third of the game, were definitely the better team.
Yeah, they were good value for it. I think, you know, it takes two to tango. Like, you can give a team opportunities and sometimes they don't take them. Or you know, when you can, if some teams, when they don't execute, they can keep a team with them. But then that team, you know, there's a sense of inevitability about some games, like, oh, they're not going to take that. Wales took their opportunities that they were given. Yes, they probably were through a discipline and then inaccuracies, they were kept in the game. But you have to play your part when that happens. And I think that's probably what I suppose the Welsh people of late have been saying that they lack, that even when they got those opportunities, they weren't taking them, or they weren't keeping themselves in those, in that fight. And there was a lot of criticism around that, but they showed grit and they stayed in the fight as well. And they took it to Ireland. They were the better team for 20, 25 minutes, really, you know, like the 20-minute red card, they were on top. And then it took a real, Bundy's inclusion to come back in and how immense he was. And then a couple of world-class moments gave Ireland that, you know, put them out to the 9 points.
That's, you mentioned Bundyaki, so let's bring him in there. I was on the live blog duty on Saturday, and I was doing player ratings afterwards, and I gave Bundyaki an 8 when I looked back on it. On reflection, I think I might have undersold his impact. He was absolutely incredible. I thought he was good in the moment, and then when I watched the match back, I think Monday morning I sat down and watched the match back again, and he was just it. Like just the sheer level of energy he brought when he came onto the pitch, and the if you actually look at the stats, he had a handful of tackles and a handful of carries. Not like numbers wise, it wasn't anything spectacular, but what he was just doing on the pitch and the sheer level of energy he brought, the punch he was putting into the carries, obviously won a huge jackal penalty that allowed Sam Prendergast kind of extend Ireland's lead and make it just a little bit more comfortable, but. Obviously, you're looking at Gary Ringrose now. We're going to assume what? 6 week ban, cut in half to 3, and a week off for tackle school. So we're almost certain he's going to miss these last two games of the Six Nations. But you're going to assume Bundyaki's going straight back in there into the starting team against France. He was outstanding.
Yeah, he was incredible. And I think that, you know, I think I'm not sure Ireland, it would have been very, very tight if it wasn't a 20-minute red card, in the sense of, you know, and there's been a lot of discussion around that, right or wrong, or how it works. But I don't think there's any, you know, well, there is intent in the Ringrose incident, as in he's going in to really, you know, physically dominate someone. So there is intent there, but I don't think there's any, I suppose, you know, there's no filthiness in it. Like, it's not, he's not, you know, in that way. So yeah, like that, this is what it was brought in for. But yeah, his energy, you could even see him when he was warming up, like the energy that was ready to, he was ready to pop. And I think Ireland having him coming off the bench like that, was probably the winning in the game. That jackal penalty kind of just, you know, summed up his whole performance and what he gave the team. He was, you know, the picture. There is no, from a rugby perspective, you know, there is no more warrior-like photograph than that photograph, you know. But yeah, it was just what Ireland needed at the time when they started to get the arm wrestle back towards their side. And then he just, as you described it already, he did apply that punch that was needed when they got to 15 men. And it was an incredible performance, and just shows what one person, what the impact one person can have for you know, in terms of a short period of time, and what a bench player can give to a game coming off when the game is still very much in the melting pot.
What are your thoughts in general on the 20-minute red card? Like, to exclude, like take away, like not even factoring in the Gary Ringrose incident this week, but as the overall concept of the 20-minute red card.
I kind of flip and flop between, my big thing on tackle technique is that, and I don't think they're harsh enough on it, to be honest. I think poor technique should be penalized. And until they really are really harsh on that, then, I think some penalties can be yellow cards, and I think yellows can be red more in the majority of cases, because a lot of it comes down to poor tackle technique. And I'd be big on, if you've poor tackle technique, you should be penalized. If you're not hinging, if you're not controlling your feet, because what it does for the younger generation is people see this and they try and, they try and emulate it. The speed into a tackle is very important, but uncontrolled speed is dangerous.
And that's that was what happened on Saturday. Like,
Yes.
people spoke about how Ben Thomas dipped into it, and obviously he does, but like, if you're looking at Gary Ringrose, you have to kind of say you're coming in there, you're pretty upright at at an uncontrollable speed.
And I think, look, when you sit down and you analyze it, I think without that dip, then yes, it's a full red card, no 20 minutes. But I do think that is the one where it's not a rugby incident, but someone does shift slightly, then I think the 20 minutes is fair. And I think that, but I do think, in my opinion, poor technique should always be penalized. Whether that's someone getting tack getting where there's no injury to the player, it's just a headshot or it's high around the neck, and the person gets up straight away, and sometimes those they can be given as penalties because, oh, it was a clumsy challenge. For me, that should be a yellow card. And then the ones where they get it wrong completely, where there's no mitigation factors, there's no dip, no change in direction, yes, full red, end of. And then these ones where it's poor technique combined with a dip or a very late change in direction, yes, that's fine. Poor technique, and then there's a mitigating factors. I think it works well, but I do think overall we need to be harsher on people with poor technique in the tackle area.
I'm kind of going off on a slight little tangent here around tackle technique and stuff, but one that always jumps out to me, and I've seen Sam Warburton in particular speak out about it a lot, is the tackling with the wrong shoulder and how often that's leading to concussions, not just for the ball carrier, but I would say actually more often for the tackler itself. And I'm curious, as someone who's like, coaching in schools and at club level, how are you dealing with that and trying to address that? Because, like, a prime example from the weekend, and one where it was in the Ireland A game, Shane Bolton makes a tackle down the left wing, and I find it more often than not it is probably wingers who are kind of scrambling across, and this one was the England winger running down the right wing, so Shane Bolton is covering across, and rather than tackling on the outside with his left, he kind of throws the body across to hit him with the dominant shoulder, and obviously you're just putting your head like straight in the path of the collision. Now, Shane Bolton got up and he was all right after it, but it is just one of the amount of times in games you see players going off for HIAs after it, but there doesn't seem at the elite level anyway to be any kind of clampdown, or like it's probably only something that teams can do internally to try eradicate it.
I think those instances, that's about repetition, and it's about confidence in the tackle zone and being able to control your body weight. You start off at a very young age. My youngest son is 7. He's just started tackling now. The big thing, they start and they all laugh like cheek to cheek, cheek to cheek. Same foot, same shoulder. But I think it's really important that from the very young age that, when I would have been taught how to tackle, I would have been on my knees. So I'm used to landing on my back. For me, a big thing now and a big thing that I would try and work on is that kids from the age when they start on their toes. So they're hunched down on their toes, they're hinged, but they're used to going forward and trying to have that train their body and their muscle memory that in a tackle they go forward in a safe way. So you land on top of the person, even though it's very, very controlled at 7, 8, 9, the ability to go forward in a tackle in a power-based position, which is your squat position, and then you're hinged at the hips, that you can go forward. I think it's very, very important that we try and bring that in as much as possible, where kids at a young age, they're not used to going back and soaking a tackle and landing on their back. If they can have some momentum, very, very controlled, even start with pads and where they just step same foot, same shoulder into a, an adult that is holding a pad, but making sure that it really does start from the ground up. I know it's a tag phrase, but it really does. And for me, it's something that we really, for our game, we have to start getting right across all age groups. The thing that we have started, particularly in school, is we get the kind of when we don't want to do massive contact, kind of bone on bone, and you see it a lot. All pro teams do. We get the bags out, so we get the high jump mat out. People will be walking, and you can actually have really good contact, really good low grade technical contact in those spaces, be it head on, side on, each side, and get multiple reps in each position. So it is at no risk to anyone because it's all pad, and the tackler is walking. You're only accelerating for 2 steps. And then you're both landing on a massive crash mat. So I just think it's repetition, and it's being really detailed in your coaching technique that helps them. We're not going to eradicate where someone gets their wrong shoulder. You're talking milliseconds in terms of how, and ultimately you want to make that tackle. But I do think, hinging and controlling your feet in the contact zone are things that, if they're not correct, they can be very, very dangerous for both.
And I just wince every time I see those kind of tackles, so that's why I brought it up. I'll bring it back onto the Ireland game now. And you mentioned obviously the big positive for Ireland was, in spite of that real wobble in the middle third of the game, it's how they just stripped everything back to the basics, knuckled down, and got themselves back into control and just kind of slowly won that arm wrestle over the rest of the game. And the big part of that, I think the lads on Against the Head on Monday night broke it down quite well, was the kicking game and how Jameson Gibson-Park and Sam Prendergast just started spraying kicks all around the place. It was an excellently managed kicking game. And even look like I'm looking at the stats here, Ireland kicked 38 times for just over 1,100 meters over the course of the game. It was only around 23-24 in the win against Scotland. Ireland are playing a lot more without the ball in this tournament. I think in the game against England, they had 51% possession. In the last two matches, it's been down at 43, which is a massive change from what we would have expected from Ireland over the last few years, where they've been a possession-based team and they go through all their phases and that's how they wear you down. This seems to be a change we're seeing in Ireland, where they seem to be a little bit happier playing without the ball.
Well, I think, look, it is that, and we've spoken about it before on here, is there an element of the Jack Nienbaer effect in that? We spoke about it around discipline, the ability to be comfortable in your D set. But pressure is a big thing on that, and pressure that you build from defense, can that breeds energy, and having a good kicking game on top of that's really important. So putting the pressure back on, the lads highlighted on Monday night that tap and go that was very unlike Jameson Gibson-Park in terms of that. When they got that penalty, he wanted to go quick. It was like the pressure was on him, and he felt I'm going to do something here, and that's, and he gets called back. Where when they're in control of that, they're okay, down, put the ball down, line out your sights on 22, launch. That's where their launches are really important. When they get into their half, into the opposition half, and they launch really, really well. But the kicking game can build so much pressure when done correctly, and the ability not to get bored, I think, will be really important against someone like France. That with their back three that they have, that if they can win those kick battles, but if France decide to kick back, be happy to go back again. And France will eventually then run because it's in their nature. And, Pierre Barry and these guys at the back, they want to attack. That if they can have good line chases in those and isolate those backfield runners in a really good kick battle, I think that will be an area of pressure that Ireland can get in and get in on France.
And the kick pressure obviously goes hand in hand with the kicking as well. Like there are, you
Yeah,
have
well, it
your
has to
you,
be technically very good. It
yeah,
has to be accurate.
you have your Sam Prendergast 50-22, or Gary Ringrose had one as well. And then there's your exit kicks, but then there's also the really important ones like James Lowe and Mac Hansen, for example, in the game against France, both had them where you're just down in the tram tracks, you punt the ball along down that 15-meter channel. And the chase that comes up. I remember from Mac Hansen's one, it was a crossfield kick over from Prendergast. He catches it, gets his kick away. But Gibson Park and Jamie Osborne are just swarming on, I think it was a Tom Rogers or it was Tom Rogers or Blair Murray who got the ball. Eventually you're rushing them into a poor exit. And it's a 25-30 meter net gain.
And the pressure that you're forcing the pressure onto them there, but you have to swarm them if you're going to build like that. And that's where Ireland, when their kicking game is accurate, it's their connections that they have and their threes and fours and how they swarm around the ball and give people, but they you have to remember they've also maneuvered people around, so they've manipulated the space that space is there, and then they go to it. They're creating it by doing something else elsewhere, still being able to fill the field and then go to that space with an accurate kick and then swarm them around. So it tactically it's very, very sharp, and ultimately it's the right thing to do. That stuff that's probably coming out of camp is, your decision on the ball is not, and that's twofold, whether it's you have a 5-on-1 and you're behind your own post, the right thing to do is actually run the ball out there. Like you're not chasing it, you're not, but that's where the space is, so that's what you're doing. The right thing to do in the in where Mac Hansen catches it, he can die with the ball there or hold it and then get it, but there's so much space in behind. He's two guys inside him. He can kick into that space and they can swarm them. So it's the correct and it's good positive decision making in those spaces.
Do you see them changing the kicking pattern a little bit, like more deep kicks against France? I would just be thinking if, like, in terms of the contestables, those box kicks, which are leading to so much more breaking ball now than ever, just with the way the contest is left open. Like, France, they're so good on that transition of broken play. Would you expect Ireland to kind of be steering away from those kind of kicks?
Well, you're going to have to do them, but you're going to have to win that. But you're going to have to win those battles. You're going to have to pick up any scraps that are there from a bouncing ball. But most importantly, you're going to have a clear, a clear connection in behind. So if someone wants to go up for the ball, be it the wingers, Lowe or Hansen, that in behind, that you're not necessarily having another guy pushing for any scraps. You're having a line in behind that's connected, so that if the scraps do bounce France's way, that you can shut that down, because that unstructured, as you said, France are absolutely lethal there. They get one offload through, and they take a defender's back, and they're up the middle. Then that becomes incredibly, incredibly hard. Where when you do kick long, and it goes deeper, at least then you're there facing into 13 lads in the front line that they're like, right, well, we don't have a whole lot to do, so we might kick it back. I think, as I said before, I think it's important that if they do go long, that they don't get bored and continue to go long, because you can frustrate them if they don't get into any type of flow. And then inside their own 10-meter line, be prepped and ready to really launch into them, and that's where you're going to attack from. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a case of, the line being normally halfway where they look to kick, where now, inside the 10, build the pressure, and then we only launch into them maybe inside the 10-meter line.
So that was the probably the big positive from Saturday was the quality of that kicking game. The the negative and the one that really needs to improve for France. A lot of the stuff around defense where they were just being kind of pulled apart, and like I think Sam Prendergast probably had his performance probably encapsulated the rest of the team, where there was so much good, but he got cut out defensively a couple of times, particularly around that try, and obviously kind of just before it, guilty of overplaying as well when spills that ball. Like Wales, you could see they were kind of going after him. They were either trying to run at him or run at the shoulder outside him. It would be foolish to expect that France aren't going to be trying to do the same thing again. So how do Ireland kind of go about protecting him, or making sure that he's protected in the defensive line?
Yeah, I think, look,
Or
the
for that,
reality.
essentially for that not to be an issue.
Yeah, I think the reality is that, every attack, goes after 10, goes after the 10 channel. I think after the last, probably particularly this weekend, it's going to be clear that they're going to try and go down his channel probably off first phase, and then look for him probably in multi-phase when he does reload back to the blind side, or when he'd be, if they get to a wide ruck, then he'd be kind of second to last defender on the open. I think how they protect him, I think one, individually he needs to make sure he has those connections, and that he has the ability to go forward and make a shot. I think that, and that particularly on the edges, that comes from getting your spacings inside and then being able to keep going forward. So for the try, he kind of, there's someone on the outside, picks out and then slightly hesitates on his heels and then goes forward, and then they get outside him. So I think for him, he probably just needs to be in a situation where he's very clear on who he has, go forward and then just make his shots. I think that's the biggest thing. I don't think there's going to be too much of a change from an all-out defensive plan. I think they just need to be better, particularly when in that unstructured situation, like any of those bouncing balls, like for that try, that they can get back into the connection real early and be able to kind of swarm them defensively. So that transition from attack into defense, I think, is going to be really, really important. It could be the winning and the losing of the game. If they can transition into defense off any unstructured attack that goes wrong well, and shut that French team down within a two or three phases, then that will go a long, long way to getting it right.
Do you expect him to start, or do you think there might be a temptation to put Jack Crowley in just for that defensive side of things? Because we have seen him at Crowley where he loves that physical contact on defence.
I can see why people would potentially be thinking that, but I think with what we've seen over the last three games, a big thing was that, I thought that Sam was going to be taken off at, with 20 to go, and then Crowley comes on and only comes on for the last 5 or 6 minutes, and is out of position. So I don't really see it. I think the writing is very clear that, this Six Nations, barring injury, is one that they're going to really let, Sam learn from, take the good with the bad that can come with younger players playing in, playing in their first 5 to 8 games for their country, and go from there. So I don't think so. I 100% see why people are saying that, but I'd be lying if I thought they were going to change it. I think the writing is clear and it's on the wall for everyone to see that these 6 games are for part of a development phase and an opportunity for him to really kick on and be better, really. And he has done very well, but he's also had poor moments, and he knows that, everyone knows that, but how is he going to get better? He'll get better by playing. Like, that's how people get better.
And as you, and obviously, like the big positive is, by being left on the pitch, he did ultimately have a major hand in navigating Ireland out of the hole that they'd found themselves in, and that obviously will stand to him.
Yeah, that's another new experience for him. You have to remember, that's a new experience. He hasn't felt that before. And closing that out, you know, in the autumn, you know, he was taken off with 2025, and you know, Casey and Crowley come on, and they're brilliant, and they close the game out. Where these games, it's been, you're in charge, you do it, and that's part of a development phase. You know, whether you agree with it or not, that's what they're doing. It's clear for everyone to see that.
Final few minutes, looking ahead, the early look, I suppose, at France next week. I was saying this on Sunday. I have no idea how to get a gauge on France. I'll be totally honest. They have had three matches, two of which were utterly dominant wins, where they ran the opposition off the pitch, and then one defeat where they were so disappointing, almost embarrassingly disappointing. So I have no idea what to make of them. Even when it comes down to team selection, like Roman Entemac is going to be back. Does he come back in? Because Thomas Ramos was so good at out half at the weekend. They obviously dropped Damien Penaud and Mathieu Jalibert as well. What happens with them next week? Because Léo Barré looked unbelievable at full back, and Adesogbe was excellent as well. Everything from performance to team selection, I have no idea what we're getting from France next week. And I'm very scared by that.
Is it a case that, you know, you hope that it's going to be raining next Saturday? You know, like that's the only thing that, you know, you look at Twickenham with what they created, and if those balls had stuck, it would have been a 30, you know, potentially a 30-point win for them. But you know, is that down to because it last rain? I don't know. You know, there seems to be a case that it wasn't like that French, that England game. They created so many opportunities. They just couldn't execute. And it was those final passes. And does that come down to conditions? I don't know. But I would be, it's like, are they, if you look at just the last two games, so Ireland against Wales and Italy against France, you'd be just ignore everything else. You'd be going, okay, well, France might be favourites come to Dublin. If they had finished, if they had won the England game, they'd probably be coming to
They'd be comfortable favourites if they'd won the England
come
game.
to And where Ireland have been, they were
Scotland.
very good against Scotland. They were very good against England in spots, but they gave up that bonus point in the last couple of minutes that, you know, that came back, that could come back to haunt them. So yeah, it's you just look at what France have, like, you name those names and like Entemac's not even playing, and you're like, oh my God, like when he come, where they have such a an abundance of riches, and those guys are, all of the names that you mentioned are X factor players, you know, that have world-class moments when they play. So yeah, it's going to be a titanic battle, but yeah, it's tight, isn't it? It's tight. I probably have France potentially, yeah, I don't know, don't want to say it, but yeah, it's going to be tight. It's going to be a great game, though.
It is, and particularly because, as you mentioned as well, the way the bonus, like the fact that Ireland led England for the bonus point, and also the fact that France have racked up two big, big wins, it kind of means now, if you look at the table, if Ireland do lose to France, it's even if they pick up a losing bonus point, it's highly unlikely that Ireland could win the championship, with it like factoring in a defeat to France. So that actually just kind of spices things up even more. This is. It's not just must win to keep a Grand Slam alive, it is probably must win to keep your hopes of winning the championship alive.
And I think that, look, it still has the same jeopardy. We all thought that this was going to be a Grand Slam decider at the start of the tournament. That's what we thought this was going to be. But with the bonus points and the points difference, it still has the same jeopardy.
Because of
It's
France's points difference, it
because of
almost
France,
is,
where, yes, it almost it's a championship decider. In reality, this game is the champion, I think, you know, because I just think with the points difference, Unless Ireland got two bonus points if they lost, and that might put potentially in the driving seat. But yeah, it's a mouth-watering tie.
Yeah, it certainly is. And we'll be talking a little bit more about it next week. Thanks a million for that, Johnny. That's been great. Still loads more to come on this week's podcast. I'll be speaking to Max Deegan in a little short while. First, though, I caught up with Hugo Keenan. Delighted to be joined by Leinster and Ireland fullback and Optimum Nutrition ambassador Hugo Keenan as Optimum Nutrition launches its Truth Unlocked campaign aimed at helping to bust common sports nutrition myths head on. Hugo, how are you doing? To start with, I suppose, following on from that, give me a common sports nutrition myth to avoid for a 34-year-old athlete in prime condition such as myself.
Hey Neil, good to see you, and thanks for having me on. Great question. I suppose there's always a bit of skepticism in around creatine and whether it's just for bodybuilders and whatnot, but I suppose as an athlete and someone who's always looking for those extra few percenters, I think there's a lot of benefit to some supplement like creatine. It's a hard one to get into your nutrition requirements just through meals and food. And there's a lot of benefits, whether it's through strength, endurance, power. So if you're hitting the gym, Neil, I'd recommend that one.
Oh, I certainly am. Obviously, in line with that, then I suppose rest and recovery is another big part of preparing yourself. You're obviously on this is the second break week of the Six Nations. I'm always curious, as players, do you feel like you really need that kind of those two break weekends dotted throughout the tournament? Because some fans always feel like that it's a bit of a momentum killer just with the narratives of the championship. But from a player's point of view, like if you were playing those five games with just one break week, like a 2 and a 3 or a 3 and a 2, would that start to take its toll by the end?
I suppose it's something that we probably do appreciate. Like they're huge physical test matches against all the nations. Your body's a bit battered and bruised after one, let alone two, and three would be even tougher. If it goes that way, so be it. It'll just be something that we'll have to adapt to, have to get better at our, I suppose, nutrition, recovery, supplementation, bits like that. We do enjoy that extra down week, I think. It's not fully a down week for us. Say, for example, this morning I was doing a bit of self-led training. I was in the gym and then I met Jemison and Jay Orr for a little run out in UCD there as well. So it's nice to get a bit of a change of scenery to do some in your own time, off your own schedule. And get the body moving again. I think I was definitely a bit more of a spring in my step than the two lads, being a bit fresher than them, missing out on the game on the weekend. So they were sort of a bit sore, a few bangs and bruises, and we're probably spending that extra little bit of time warming up and getting the body right before they could crack into the session. So that even gives you a little bit of an example of what a bit of a weekend off or that extra week might give you.
Yeah, and obviously 3 rounds down, 3 wins in a row, France and Italy still to come. I suppose the beauty of the situation you're in is now, regardless of what happens against France in whatever 10, 11 days' time, you will be going to Italy on St. Patrick's weekend with a chance of winning the title, whether or not it's in your hands or whatever. But as in, regardless of what happens now, you're going into that last weekend knowing that you are going to be at the very least in contention. The other
Yeah, I
but the
suppose
other.
we don't exactly look at it that way. I suppose we more look at it, we're three from three, we're in a great position, we're where we want to be. But I suppose our focus is on this France game. I think we're going out to win it, where we wanna have it in our control and in our hands. And I think it's an important 12 days now in the lead up to the French game. Taking the learnings from Wales, getting back together tomorrow, training well, and getting that little head start on France that extra week gives you. So Yeah, we know what sort of a challenge it'll be, how tough of a game it'll and how much of a performance it'll take to beat a French side in good form. So yeah, it's an exciting time. It's where we want to be, as we said. And yeah, looking forward to getting stuck into it and hopefully being out there in a packed out Aviva on Saturday week.
And obviously in Cardiff, you get to come home with an extra little bit of cargo, the Triple Crown. It must be nice to have that as a little bit of a stepping stone during the championship, as just a nice marker to kind of to hit. Because I do remember in like 2023 when Ireland win the Grand Slam, and I suppose the Triple Crown obviously ended up being a little bit of an afterthought. It was only at the presentation where I was going, oh God, yeah, they're getting that as well. So to I suppose just to have that as a nice little marker, because I think a lot of probably younger listeners or younger Irish rugby fans are probably so used to winning Triple Crowns. But I remember 2004 when Ireland won it for the first time in 20 odd years and how big a deal that was. Like it is a big thing to do. It's only been done 14 times by Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. It's still an achievement in itself, as you were saying, Neil. Like, it's something that we were targeting, something that we were getting excited by. The fact that the first three games were going to decide that Triple Crown and the opportunity that it had, and it was that little bit of extra motivation to do it, that it's a bit more in the spotlight. So it was nice. It was nice to lift a bit of silverware. It was a special moment for Dan being captain for the first time and sharing that honor with Caelan. And it was good that it came on a week where we had a bit of downtime after that we could enjoy each other's company, we could enjoy a beer together and acknowledge that achievement that it is, because I suppose we don't take it for granted ever. Either putting on a jersey, but lifting a green jersey, but lifting a trophy in a green jersey is always special. And yeah, it was a good memorable day for a lot of the team, a lot of the coaching staff, backroom staff, but also, as you were saying, the support, the kids, and I suppose fans out there who really appreciate it. And yeah, I certainly remember growing up seeing Ireland lifting triple crowns was really cool and something exciting.
Yeah, and I suppose you don't want to ever normalize that moment. You want to be able to enjoy those days. Is that something you all are very conscious of, that, good days don't always come around. You may as well make the most of them when they do.
Absolutely. Like, we don't get ahead of ourselves. Like, we knew there's bigger fish to fry. There's a bigger objective to the whole Six Nations, and that we're going to be just looking at France now and turning the page pretty quick. But at the same time, like, it is important to mark those days somewhat, if that's a beer or two in the change room after or in the hotel, and just enjoying each other's company. We're lucky to be in an environment where the coaches, whether it's Faz or Simon, encourage that, and they know it's an important part of growing that sort of collective nature of a squad.
You obviously weren't playing on Saturday, but you were there in Cardiff with the squad. I'm always fascinated by the role maybe that like a senior player like yourself would have on a day like that, where you're not strictly obviously in the 23, but you are there and part of the party. Like, are you working with Jamie Osborne a lot in the days coming up to the match? Are you maybe in there in the change room with them at half time to run through a couple of things, give a bit of feedback, or come kick off, are you kind of taking a back seat?
A small bit of all that, I suppose, Neil. Throughout the week, like, you definitely do have a big responsibility, whether to prepare the team, whether you're in the bibs on the actual pitch, putting up a good standard side against them, trying to be as similar to Wales as you can. But then also, like, every week the back three get together, whoever's playing, whoever's not playing, and help each other. So whether it's me or Jamie, everyone would be feeding in, looking at whether it's their kicking game, whether it's their scrum stuff, counter-attack stuff, any of their phase play. So to be fair, we've built up an environment that whoever is selected is helped by all the lads who aren't, and vice versa. And hopefully I was of some use to Jamie last week. But to be fair to him, come sort of the 48 hours leading up to a game, he had done the work. He was ready, and you could see that in his performance. And you obviously saw that with Lowie and Mac as well, going well too.
Would you tailor your feedback towards, like, if you know the person involved that, okay, this person likes being spoken to a lot, this
A
person
little
prefers to
bit.
be kind of left on their own to work things
Exactly.
out?
That's the sort of connections and friendships you build up in camp. I get on so well with Jamie, Lowie, and Mac. But yeah, you know when to be saying something to one and nothing to another. And sometimes you might have a word or two at half time. There was nothing really of note for me to say to them, or whether it's to Simon and around D or Goody in attack. But yeah, you're there before the game, you're there at half time if needs be, helping the lads. They might have questions, are you seeing anything in the stand, etc., and being of use for them throughout the day and throughout the week as best you can.
You obviously didn't get to play much rugby between the November internationals and the Six Nations. Just that you got that one match in against Bath before the start of the championship. When you were off and probably watching a lot more rugby over those 6 weeks or so, were you intensely studying how teams were trying to manipulate the new interpretation around the escort lines and the kicking game, just to try see what way teams are approaching it? Do you feel like you have a better handle on that now?
Yeah, I think so. Like as you say, when you're in games, when you're playing matches, you sort of don't get to watch a whole lot of rugby other than the game you're involved in, the opposition you're playing against, and scouting them. You'd obviously watch the odd big game or provincial game or international game that's on, but I definitely found myself over that sort of December period watching a lot more, whether it's European rugby, Premiership, whatever, because you've a bit more time on your hands. You're not traveling over on the weekend. You can watch a bit of live sport. You're not worrying about, I suppose, performing on the weekend. So yeah, there are little cues that you pick up here and there, little trends that you see teams picking up in attack. And it's definitely in and around the kicking games changed between the 50-22 rule coming in last year, and now sort of a bit less protection in and around the aerial and fielding high balls has come in more recently. So I suppose it's an exciting time for a back three, and an interesting one too, to see what's the best way of going about it from an attacking and defensive point of view. And yeah, it's been good.
And you had Brian Fenton in, which he a couple of on the previous break week as well.
He was brilliant. Like he's obviously had such a successful career in Dublin, six All Irelands in a row. So we were picking his mind in around his mentality of keeping that level of consistency going throughout a sustained period of time. But then also he was doing a bit of work with the back three and backs in around high ball stuff, and had a few good cues for us in around the breaking ball. And Andrew Goodman was picking his brain as well as us and encouraging him to get involved. And I think it was cool to see Jamie's try on the weekend, coming off the back of Lowie's sort of slap back. And it's something that we were definitely talking about with them. So you might have to give a little bit of credit to Fento and to Goody in and around that, and the sort of cues we picked up off them and little tips and tricks.
Absolutely. And I think James Lowe, he was speaking to the media afterwards as well, and he hinted as well that kind of Gaelic football or Aussie rules hands over the head kind of catch might be coming a bit more popular than the traditional into the breadbasket kind of stance.
I think challenging yourself to catch it overhead obviously is going to be a higher point than catching it in the traditional breadbasket, as you call it. I think different kicks determine which ones you go for, whether it's sometimes overhead isn't doable on certain styles of kicks or kickers. And yeah, I think the challenge now is in and around decision making of when to do it or not. Is it a greasy ball? Is it windy day? Things like that also come into play as well. So we were picking Bento's mind in and around that, and have been challenging ourselves, whether it's Johnny Sexton challenging us, Goody challenging us to grow and evolve in that area. And I think it's been an exciting sort of little work on for us as a back three, and an exciting part of the game going forward.
And just final question or so as well. It's been really interesting to see over these three games where I think a lot of people would have had fairly natural kind of maybe slight concerns just about the Andy Farrell being away and, you know, a small bit of a change around in that coaching setup and wondering how ye would react. Has that kind of given ye an extra little bit of motivation that you wouldn't let those standards slip that he's been away? And like, are you almost feeling that there's a bit of a refresher kind of that's gone on at the moment where Andy will come back in later on in the year and everyone's had this little break away from each other?
I wouldn't see it as a refresher, really. I'd say it's more of a testament to what Andy and the coaches have put in over the last few years, that standards don't just drop off straight away when he goes away. I think we know he's still watching from a distance, with a keen eye and monitoring things, I'm sure. And we don't want to let ourselves down in that period. But it's also a case where, like, the coaching group have really stepped up, whether it's Simon, Goody, Paulie, Fogs have been brilliant on filling the void, that the big void that he has left. And yeah, they're enjoying the challenge. We're enjoying the challenge and the different environment of him not being in. And I think it's also on players to step up as well. Lads have been great from a leadership point of view, helping out the coaches. And I think it's when big boots are to be filled, we can't just rely on Simon to do that and have to help and get around him and grow the group together.
And just final question then. I'm sure you're hoping you could possibly link up with Andy over the summer down in Australia with the Lions. You were obviously just an international rookie when the last Lions tour was coming around.
I suppose back 2021, I was only on the scene for a year or so. It was probably too early in my career. And it's something exciting going down the line, but it's definitely something you can't get caught up thinking of. Like, I think we're in a lucky position to be playing for Ireland, in a position where we're three out of three so far, and we've two huge games coming up, and I don't think you can look past those. And you don't want to keep your eye on something else and miss out on what's in front of you. So over the next 12 days, it's just going to be full focus on France, on getting a team and hopefully an individual performance if I'm selected, and getting that win that we're all chasing, and that performance to go along with it.
All right, well, Hugo, it's been great speaking to you. Very best of luck next week against France, and enjoy your hard-earned weekend off.
Cheers, Neil. Thanks for the chat.
Now, for the final leg of this week's podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Max Deegan, who, as part of Leinster Rugby's partnership with Energia, is helping to promote Seachtain na Gaeilge. Max, how are you? Good to
I'm
speak to
good,
you.
yeah. No, I'm great form, yeah.
One of my big regrets in life is not trying harder at Irish in school, and I will absolutely say I just did not try hard enough. How's your Gaeilge?
I think I'm in the same boat as you, to be honest. Probably regretting not putting a bit more effort in Irish class, that's for sure.
Yeah, but I suppose it, like, I mean, it is one of those things that we can obviously go and work on it now in later life.
Yeah, exactly. Probably taking more ownership on that.
Well, I mean, you can use it to, I was thinking you can use this to your benefits, of course, because, like, you know, if you're playing against a Welsh side or a Scottish team or the French or Italians, I mean, have a few little line-out calls there in the back pocket, Os Gaeilge. And I mean, if you need to, I know a lot of this stuff is pre-called, but if you need to throw in an audible up at the line, you know, you can
No,
go for that and
definitely.
not give away the plan.
Yeah, because I know what that's like playing against the South African teams, and We got last year we had Jason and he's trying to tell us what they're saying in South African and I'm trying to understand it and then so maybe we should try to flip it on them and do something Irish.
Absolutely, absolutely. Listen, you're back with Leinster this week, home against Cardiff on Saturday. I do want to ask about your experiences with Ireland A, though, because we spoke to you last Tuesday ahead of the game. You were obviously really looking forward to it. It obviously was a difficult afternoon. So many things went against you just with the injuries and the weather conditions. It ended up being a very messy afternoon, but was it a worthwhile experience overall?
Yeah, it was definitely a worthwhile experience. I thought we started the game really well, really competitively, like a score apiece, and we could even have one or two more. And then obviously when the injuries happen and you lose 1-10, you lose another 10, you lose one of your back threes and you've only got two backs on the bench, then you end up with having me on the wing for 30 minutes, which is not ideal. But no, definitely a worthwhile experience, great experience for all the younger lads and then even some of the older lads getting back in the mix and back in the campus and chatting to the coach and things like that.
I was curious when that happened. Obviously, you going out onto the wing for a good chunk of the second half. Had that been discussed in advance that look, because obviously that you were going 6-2 on the bench and there are risks involved with that, was it decided in advance that if there is complete injury mayhem and we do have to move a backer out into the back line, that it would be you? Or was that an in the moment you as captain saying, do you know what, I'll just move out here and take this one on?
It was actually, well, like, sure, we only had 1 week to prepare, so we didn't really have every eventuality ironed out before the game. We kind of briefly talked about it, and then we said, look, we'll figure it out on the pitch if anything like that happens. We're all smart rugby players, so we can figure it out if it happens. So, yeah, just decided we'll throw me on the wing and bring on one of the other lads.
Yeah, and like I suppose the game itself was just probably the end point of the week, but as yourself and who else were we chatting to, Mike Prendergast and Shane Daly as well last Tuesday as well, a huge part of that was just about the whole experience of the week and for maybe fellas like yourself getting back into the HPC to get some face time with the right people. For other players at the earlier stage of their careers, it was like their first step in towards the senior environment. As a whole week, I'm sure it was a very worthwhile, challenging, enjoyable experience.
Yeah, definitely. Like really enjoyable meeting all the lads. There's so many players in the squad that I'd never met before. So, getting to meet them and have a bit of crack with them, that was the main focus at the beginning of the week was just, build those connections. You have a week to go up against an English A team. You need to make sure that you first of all know each other's names and then make sure you know how each other play and things like that.
Was there anyone in there whose impression changed on you? That you maybe only would have played against them, but maybe you got to know them a little bit better. Anyone in particular that you found to be a good hang?
To be honest, I found them all very very sound. It was probably some of the to be honest, all of them. You go up against them in interprovincial and you're not they're not your biggest fans and you're not their biggest fans. So, but then when you meet them 1-on-1, you have a bit of crack with them. They're all sound. They're all great blokes.
Yeah, one of those things where, oh, it turns out when you're on my team, we actually get on just fine.
Exactly. Yeah, it's going to be annoying now when we play against them and I'm trying to hate them again.
Obviously, that, like, I mean, you were all kind of mingling around the HPC, but you were training separately to the senior team just because you couldn't fit that many players on a pitch at the same time. Would you have had a chance to get any face time with like Simon Easterby, the senior management, any kind of feedback coming off the back of the week?
Not since the game. Maybe a little bit through more so like Sean O'Brien. Obviously, he was involved in the coaching staff. So been chatting to him over the last 2 days about things that he was happy with and things that the coaches are seeing and things like that, which is great. And then during the week last week, it was nice to just even just catch them for a minute or so, walking by the facilities, chat to them a little bit. It's always great to show a face in that regard.
Absolutely. Something else you spoke about last week that kind of wanted to follow up on as well, like the level of back row kind of talent right around the country just seems to be a position Ireland have been producing in for years now. And it kind of became relevant last week where Caelan obviously misses out through injury ahead of the Wales game. And, he'd played 42 matches in a row for Ireland, which is just a staggering number, and was pointed out maybe. Had it not, had he had his endurance and durability not been so good, maybe yourself or Nick Timoney or Gavin Coombs might have picked up a few more caps across the last few years. How has it been staying motivated and ready for being able to kind of come in if there is an injury at some stage? Because I'm sure there have been challenging points over the last few years for yourself and, like, as I said, other players around the country who've been in your position who are performing week on week with provinces, but obviously because of people just are continuing to produce for Ireland and not getting injured, that it's so hard to get in the door.
Yeah, of course. Like it's not easy at times, and there's been periods where you question this and that. But I guess the biggest thing for me was just focusing on myself and focusing on my own performance. And if that was getting better, and I was proud of the work I was putting in, it's a lot easier then to deal with these kind of decisions. And if you don't get picked, well, look, I've tried my my best and I've given it all I can. There might be things out of my control that might happen, whether it be injuries or things that you can't control, like selection. So once I'm working hard and I'm proud of the work I'm putting in and, turning up every week for Leinster and, giving it my all, that's all I can do. And, being in Leinster and having such a great group of guys, still makes, playing rugby so enjoyable. And, we're going well, Leinster, at the moment, so it's easy to just focus on Leinster and just keep pushing forward there.
Have there been particular elements or just even one element of your game that maybe in the last year or two you've kind of really honed in on, kind of an area to upskill, or maybe it might be a strength of your game that you kind of want to make a super strength?
Yeah, I feel like my line it was always a strength of mine. As I was playing eight, but I think I really honed in on that, defensively and then obviously in attack as well. But really honed in on that, and making a point of difference. And obviously, I've played a lot of six this year. Where in the past I probably would have played a lot of eight. So that's something that I've really, I feel like, grabbed hold of over the last maybe 2 seasons and really, try to make it a point of difference for myself. And then the other one is just kind of, defense. Now the Jacks come in really hammering down on, tackle technique and tackle selection, trying to make an impact there for the team.
I'm always fascinated by like the real defensive line-out specialists, and I think one of the things that really stands out, like I'd see it now with like Peter O'Mahony and Ryan Baird when they're playing with Ireland, is there's a ridiculous almost like fearlessness in the spring to get up into the air. There's an incredible amount of trust that there must be with you and the lifters beneath you. That I mean, you're flinging yourself up into the air there, and it must be difficult to kind of. I'm sure it's a skill that's been honed over 20 years of playing rugby, the way back into school, but kind of getting it out of your mind that I'm just throwing myself up there and I'm at the mercy of the people below me.
There's definitely an element of trust there, but it's more so I'd be far angrier at my lifters if they didn't lift me than if they lifted me and threw me into next year over the line out. So I don't mind it at all. It's something that, like, I get really excited about, is coming into a game as line of defense and the chance to, pinch a few balls. Obviously myself, Berto and Leinster, and then Alexis Soraka, we'd probably be kind of the main focus on D in Leinster, and we'd put a lot of effort into it in training and things like that, and working off each other, and just making sure that our lifters lift us, because if they don't, I'm going to be telling them.
Absolutely. Back at Leinster then, obviously once the Six Nations is over, like you're really into the coming into the meatier end of the season. Champions Cup knockouts are there. URC, as we say, is back this week. But after Six Nations, you are heading into the real tough end of it. Trip to South Africa, obviously in the mix there as well. Ultimately, though, as we've seen in the last few years, like Leinster, because of the high standards you set throughout the season, you get judged on your last game or two of a campaign. How difficult is it to, well, maybe not difficult, maybe enjoy it, but the high standards that are involved there that you're being judged off, it makes the stakes incredibly high this time of year.
Yeah, look, it's a privilege, I guess, to have those high stakes and have that pressure. If it was the other way around, sure, that's not what you want at all. You want to be seen as a team that's going to be winning Champions Cups, URCs every year. And then obviously with that comes pressure, but we try not to let it overcome us at all. It's not something actually we've talked about at all so far this season, is the finals or anything like that. It's always been, cliches, it is the next game or the next block of games, maybe. So at the moment we're focusing this week on Cardiff, and then we've got an eye towards South Africa as well. But we haven't looked any further past that. We haven't looked at Champions Cup or any of those games, which probably helps in terms of that pressure, because you don't want to be thinking about those games now, and then the pressure just builds and builds and builds, and then when you get to the game, it's ridiculous. So again, like I said, it's something that we're privileged to have, is that pressure in those for those competitions. But something we love.
You've obviously made, like, there have been big additions to the squad this season, the likes of Jordi, Barrett, Orji Snyman, Rabah Slimani as well. And I've all added, obviously, on the pitch. It does seem as well, and I'm going to specifically single out, well, not single out, but two of them, Orji and Rabah, they seem to be immensely popular people in the dressing room. I think every time we see photos from, the bits of warm-ups before training or stuff like that, or after matches, they seem to have. I'm not saying Jordy hasn't, but the two of them in particular just seem to have fitted in perfectly as characters in the team.
Yeah, definitely. Well, obviously they're all great characters. Jordy's a great guy, but the two lads are just, they're gas, like two hilarious individuals. Orgies, he's in the room beside me, so I won't speak too loud, but he's a bit crazy. He's a lot of energy. And then Rabah, his English wouldn't be the great, but he's just an unbelievably happy, funny character. So all three of them have added so much to the change room, and then obviously on the pitch you can see what they're doing. Whether it's Rabah, destroying scrums, or it's Orji offloading, or it's Jordy running amok, like they're all adding so much to the team and the squad as a whole. So it's been a pleasure to have them this year. Yeah.
On Orji, like particularly at the lineouts as well. Have you had to word at him and say, like, are you putting some kind of mad sticky spray onto your hands or something with the way he's grabbing those one-handed catches?
No, it's not fair. His hands are enormous, honestly. I think if I could improve one thing about my body, it'd be bigger hands, because it seems to be the most overpowered thing you can have in a rugby pitch. Yeah.
Well, and have you prepared yourself for if you do get a bit of silverware this year? I mean, that man has a He's got a reputation for
He
ripping
does, yeah.
jerseys. You have to
He
stay.
does, yeah.
Are you preparing yourself for the fact that if you do win, you got to keep away from him on a night
Yeah,
out?
definitely. Yeah. We had a bit of a taster at the Chris's party. He was definitely shown us that side to himself. So I'll definitely be prepared. Potentially won't be wearing my nicer, most expensive t-shirt out that night. Yeah.
All right, good stuff. Well, listen, best of luck for the rest of the season. Congrats on getting back in with the Ireland mix last week as well. Max Deegan, as part of Leinster Rugby and Energia's partnership with Energia. Thanks for joining us. For more information, see energia.ie/Shochtain-na-Hochtain-Gaeilge. And a reminder as well, URC double header this weekend on RT2 and RT Player. Leinster against Cardiff. And Ulster versus the Scarlets. That all gets underway from 2:30 p.m. We'll speak to you soon.
Cheers, Neil.